Today we're talking about the Joseph story, and Corbin read for us a small portion of it, but I want to talk about a little bit more of the story before we get further into it. First, a little bit of context of where we find the story of Joseph. It starts in the 36th, 37th chapter of the book of Genesis, and largely goes through the end of the book, is about Joseph. Genesis is really divided into four or five sections. There's the prehistory, or so it's called, of the creation stories, the flood, the Tower of Babel, and all of that. Then comes the story of Abraham, then the story of Isaac, and then the story of Jacob. And really, the Joseph story is actually part of the story of Jacob, if you were to think about the way that the book of Genesis was organized by those who put it together for us. This week I was reading, and Eugene Peterson referred to Joseph as the last patriarch. And in some ways, it is a story of a patriarch, but he's not actually thought of as one of the patriarchs. When you read in other places in the Bible and they talk about the God of someone, they talk about the God of Abraham and Isaac and Joseph sometimes Jacob, but he's not thought of in the same light as these others. He's thought of a little differently. And part of it's because if you read this book, compared to the stories about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the story of Joseph is quite a bit different in its structure and in its content. One of the things is it reads like a little novella. I think HBO should probably get the licensing rights and do like a 10-series episode on the story of Joseph. It would work, trust me. Walter Brueggemann says that it's not a collection of unordered tribal memories, as is the case with the story centered around Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In fact, it has a structure and a shape to it that the others don't necessarily have, that they seem a little disjointed at times. So that's one uniqueness of it. It's very much a story. You can read it like a novel. There's a strange interjection about his brother Judah and about Tamar and that whole story that exists within the story. But the flow of Joseph's story very much reads like a small novella. Another thing that makes it unique from the stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob is that God is never a direct actor in the story of Joseph. God is present, God is implied, God is there and at work, but as is the story where God shows up and speaks in other stories, where God makes things happen, the presence of God as told through the story of Joseph is more subtle and nuanced than that. God is at work in the machinations of life and how things unfold in the people's world, but God's presence is almost more implied than directly involved. Not a direct actor, but a mystery, an indirect in the story. And maybe that's why Joseph isn't always thought of as a patriarch, and maybe that's why he's thought of as part of the Jacob narrative. So that's a little bit of the context of where we find the story, but there's questions because of those things that we can ask. If it has such a different shape, and if perhaps it has such a different purpose, maybe it comes from a different time and place and leads us to ask different questions than we might ask of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Again, Walter Brueggemann, reflecting on this story, says, "The primary question for Joseph is not when this happened, but in what context and why it was told." What context did this story come from, and why did they tell the Joseph story? And that's how I want us to think about it today. First, the story, you remember, goes way back. Joseph is the favored son, right? He's not the oldest born. He's not born into his privilege, but he's favored by his father and is given that privilege. He has his coat of many colors, all of these things, this blessing that he receives from his father, which leads to a reaction from his brothers that's well-rooted in the expectations of their time. They would have expected some sort of privilege or status because of being older, but here was Joseph, the one that was favored. It leads to a story of confusion and betrayal from his brothers, right? You remember the story where they take him out to the wilderness and they're gonna do away with him, but they can't bring themselves to do it, so they put him in a pit, and then what happens? They go away from the pit, and when they come back, somebody else has taken their brother and sold him, and he's gone. So the coat is there, they dip it in blood, they take it back to his father and say, your son is dead. Joseph ends up in Egypt through the story, and he's imprisoned in Egypt, and we know the stories where he becomes an interpreter of dreams and the dramas that unfold therein, and that leads to him not only rising up out of prison, but it leads to the cunning, it leads to his rise to power and the whole scene with Potiphar's house and the wife and how he gets himself out of there. And then he finds himself as an officer, as a powerful person in the land of Egypt, in some ways living into this promisedness of the promised son of Jacob, but in a different context, living that out in Egypt. And then with the famine that he predicted from the dream of the Pharaoh, you remember he said 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine, so save up. And then lo and behold, here comes his family to Egypt, hungry, starving, and desperate. And that's the story that we read today. The encounter with his brothers, who he recognizes them, and he knows who they are. This back and forth, this playing games with them a little bit about going back to your father, but in the end, providing for them, loving them, caring for them, and in the end, not just doing that, but reconciling with them. It becomes a relationship not of a Lord doing something for people, but of a brother living in and amongst and with his family again. It's a beautiful story in that regard. I'm telling you, HBO, they should do it. Why was this story told? Why would we want to read this story? Why would they want to read the story? Not just their own history. There's more to it than that. We don't tell history just to know what happened. We tell history to help us know who we are and how to live today and into the future. Why was it told? First, I think there's an important lesson in the Joseph story about God's relentless and persistent pursuit of life and justice. There's a lot of people that think that because of the language that's in the Joseph story, because of the creativity, because of the nuanced way that it talks about God, that maybe the Joseph story comes from late in the reign of Solomon as the king of Israel. A time, if you know your biblical history, late in the reign of Solomon, where things are starting to crumble for the people. Things are starting to fall apart. They're starting to lose status. There's enemies at their doors. There's division within their community. There's anxiety and there's stress. And there's all of this tearing at the fabric of who they are as God's people. And it's a time that maybe, just maybe, the idea of a nuanced God that's not speaking directly and clearly is exactly what they were experiencing. Right? Life was hard. Things were falling apart. There were people with a lot of power, but there was an awful lot of people who weren't. And maybe the Joseph story was one that came out of that context, where God was perhaps silent, but God in mystery. They needed that hopeful word of God who's working for life and justice and love. It reminds us of the essential place of hope that we all need in challenging times. If the setting was towards the end of the Solomonic reign, when the challenges of society seemed to be collapsing in on the people, in the midst of this story, we get first a vision of the relentless pursuit of life and justice and love, that even if it all collapsed, that God's will and purpose was going to continue. It's something that they're experiencing. That word hope, right? That word that we need to hold on to. Bringing it to our own context, do you ever feel like you're just adrift at sea? Rootless and lost. Maybe things happening in your personal life, maybe stuff that's happening around you in society, in the world, there's just so much in life, perhaps, and in our world that just feels like relentless waves that toss you back and forth and pull you under, and you can't escape from it. And you're just tired of fighting it. The Joseph story is one that's told into a context like that of confidence in the divine presence of God. That even in what we call ordinary, even in what we call secular, even in what does not seem like the direct action of God that maybe is more nuanced, that there's glimpses of the pursuit of justice and life and love that we experience in our world and in our lives that keep us rooted in something far greater than the waves that crash in on us. There's something moving and that we experience that gives us help, that gives us hope and help to carry on. It's a fixed point on the shore where we continue to paddle and we continue to pursue, knowing that God's reign will come. It's relentless hope. That's the story of Joseph. That's the promise that we hear from God and listening to the experience of Joseph and his brothers. We need vision that God's justice will prevail and that babies won't be separated from their parents forever, right? We need hopeful vision in our society. We need hopeful vision that our church can be something more just and compassionate for those who carry a large burden of judgment and shame. We need hope and vision that life and flourishing are possible and that there's no need for all these people to live on the streets in our city. We need relentless hope that means that whatever burden of guilt we carry, whatever shame shackles us, can be let go and released in the name of the God whose purpose is life and life abundantly, who for the sake of freedom sets us free, who so loves the world, period. Hope is the vision and the compulsion to action that, despite the circumstances, proclaims that God's justice, life, and love will prevail. That the boy sold into slavery will be a ruler and a hero. That the starving family will find care and food. That broken relationships will find healing and wholeness. That mourning will turn to dancing. That cries of pain will be replaced with tears of joy. And that hatred, sorrow, violence, and death will be no more. The Joseph story is about the relentless hopefulness of life in and with God, and hope is the vision and the compulsion to action that, despite the circumstances, God's justice, life, and love will reign. Period. Second reason the story is told: it's an image of reordering of a society, of reconciliation, and of forgiveness. The story of forgiveness is obvious, right? His brothers who cast him aside, who place judgment and shame on him, his own rise to power. And there's this image where they come back together as a family. But I want to step back even further and ask the question, maybe, just maybe, there's some forgiveness of Joseph that his brothers need to be receiving as well. Because this is also a story of the right use of privilege, right? Joseph is given privilege by his father over his brothers, right? So it's not just them who have done something to him. He has taken a place above and a status above them, and there's reconciliation work that needs to happen there as well. And what's amazing about this story in Genesis 45, and then we read it, is that it's not when he claims the privilege of the status granted to him by his father that they recognize him and that they come back together. No, it's when he claims the title brother that they know who he is. Read it. Look. At first, they don't know. And then he says, I am Joseph, your brother. And their eyes are opened, and they know who he is. And a new community has been formed. Think of it this way. I mentioned this language earlier, but semantics matter, right? Language matters a lot about how we talk about things. And sometimes in churches, we talk about ministry for a group of people rather than ministry with a group of people, right? One is paternalistic. One is familial. And it matters what posture we take and what nature the relationship is that we have with one another. Joseph is the last patriarch, not just because his is the story of a patriarch, but because Joseph is an example of the ending of patriarchy altogether. God is painting a new understanding of community and telling us this story that it's not rulers and judges and lords, but it's sisters and brothers and kin that is God's purpose for us. It's a story of reconciliation. There's acknowledgement of truth. There's acts of forgiveness, and there's steps forward. There's steps forward into a new relationship. And a theological point that I think matters here, right, is that the word brother, that as it's used in chapter 45, maybe doesn't mean the same thing as the way the word brother is used in chapter 37, right? Jesus says, who are my brother and my mother, right? brotherhood, sisterhood, kinship. It's not rooted in biology, but instead in spirituality and the new form of humanity that's created. Kinship is a choice we make when we journey together in God's vision and future for all. The Joseph story is about toppling our understandings of privilege and status and calling us to a new community of kinship marked by truth-telling and reconciliation, where the only status that matters is that we are sisters and brothers and kin, children of the same God. In anxious and troubling times, they hear the Joseph story, one of relentless hope, one of relentless pursuit of life and justice and love for all, that despite when things seem their worst, that God is continuing to move and is leading in the way towards justice, the long arc of justice, as Dr. King called it. And it's also a story of reconciliation and community, that they move forward as brothers, but in a new way, not based just on their common fatherhood or motherhood, but on the choice to live together with God. They move forward with a vision of life together, their kinship that's marked by unity in sisterhood and brotherhood. It's a story of human flourishing, and it's a story of human unity. It's a story of hope, and it's a story of reconciliation. It's important that they come in that order, and I think we need to think about it that way. You can't have unity without a commitment to the flourishing of all, right? It'll be an oppressive unity where some carry the weight and others don't. That's not kinship, that's lordship, and that's patriarchs and patriarchy. And that's not the story that's being told here. It's a story of everyone flourishing so that everyone can live together because there's one God and Father of us all. It's been said we live in anxious and troubling times. The news is testimony to that. Our own experiences are testimony to that. There's incidental evidence as well. Do you know people are seeing doctors and counselors more recently than they have in the past? People are also being unkind and unjust to each other more, just in interpersonal relationships. And it feels like sometimes we are lost at sea, being battered by waves. But today, let the current of God's relentless pursuit of life, justice, and love give us hope that today, let the current of God's relentless pursuit of life and justice and love give us hope no matter what burden we carry. Today, let the possibility of unity, of reconciled sisterhood and brotherhood give us courage, whatever guilt or shame we may be bearing. And for any of you here who are struggling, or you know someone who's struggling to pursue life and justice and love and pursue hope and reconciliation, just make the phone call to hear that you're loved, or make the call to let someone else know that they are loved, that God's intention is for them to flourish, and that we are a brotherhood and sisterhood that gathers around each other in a common love. Hope and reconciliation, as is so much that we discuss, hope and reconciliation are both a gift and a task. They're a gift given by God, and it's our task to pursue it with a similar relentless fervor that believes deeply in the God who loves us and who believes deeply in the God that binds us together with unbreakable cords.